Today on Maine Calling, an update on the flu, COVID, and other public health concerns. We're in the thick of flu season right now, and it's an ugly one, with more cases reported this year than last. A surge in flu cases closed the Calais school system a couple of weeks ago, and other after-school programs have scaled back because of illness. Plus, public health officials who monitor wastewater are seeing an increase in the COVID virus as well. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with leaders at Maine's largest hospital systems about what they're seeing and where. We'll find out what we can all do to protect ourselves and if it's too late to be vaccinated. Plus, we'll discuss how and whether the new Trump administration policies are affecting Maine's healthcare and medical research. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Cases of the flu are spiking in Maine, and high COVID levels are showing up in wastewater tests. Today, we're going to talk about these infectious diseases and other public health concerns. Joining me for the hour, Dr. Dora Mills, who is Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. James Jarvis, Director of Clinical Education for Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you one of those people who is affected by the flu that's going around, somebody in your family or somebody in your workplace? Are you thinking about whether it's too late to get a vaccine? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Jarvis, I'll start with you. We're talking about flu and COVID, but, you know, anything else that you all are also seeing at the hospitals in Maine, what does it look like there? I keep hearing about people I know getting flu. Are these cases serious? Are these people hospitalized?
Well, good morning, Jen, and thank you for having us back. Yes, I think there are some people who are experiencing some severe illness from both flu and COVID, but also from RSV. We have had reports of children being admitted for infections with RSV. And so it's really that triple-demic. And then add on to that we have a nationwide outbreak of norovirus as well, which is a gastrointestinal virus. So it's kind of four different things that are going on out there, plus the usual colds and stuff that happen as well. Dora can talk about what's happening at Maine Health, but at Northern Light Health, we are seeing an increase in activity, particularly in our outpatient settings with people coming in with flu-like symptoms and testing positive for influenza A and influenza B. It's a little bit early in the season for influenza B, but we're seeing more of those numbers a little bit earlier than we usually do. And then, of course, COVID and RSV as well. As far as hospitalizations go, we really haven't seen at Northern Light a huge increase in admissions for influenza and COVID. But certainly that impacts a lot of things that we're able to do, because if our staff get sick with those things, they are out. That means that we have less staff. But overall, our hospitals still are very full. They're full with lots of other things, including to respiratory illnesses. So we still have the people coming in with things like surgical emergencies or illnesses that cause them to come in, like their diabetes or their heart disease, or people with heart attacks and things like that. And so our hospitals are very full. And then you add to that now the burden of, even if it's lower numbers than we saw during the pandemic of people coming in with influenza and COVID, it still just adds to the overall burden of what our hospitals have to take care of.
All right. And Dr. Mills, let me ask you this. If you're not feeling well, how do you know what you have and whether it's bad enough to see the doctor? Give us some guidance. So I wake up tomorrow and I don't feel very good. Do I go back to bed? Do I have some water, or do I go to my doctor because I might have influenza or COVID?
Yeah, you know, great question. And it There's a lot of depends. It depends a lot on your overall health status. So if you are somebody at high risk and for severe COVID or influenza or RSV, and you are having symptoms, fever, cough, sore throat, respiratory symptoms, those kinds of things, then yeah, you would want to call your PCP. You contact your primary care provider sooner than later. If you're somebody who's not at high risk, but you work someplace, you probably want to stay home from work, and especially if you've got a fever, you need to stay home. We ask you to stay home. So it depends a lot. And then contact your PCP if you get so sick that you're having a hard time, not getting better after 2 or 3 days, or if you're having a hard time breathing, or you can't keep anything down for, a few hours and you're getting dehydrated. So it depends a bit on your situation.
Okay. And I'll ask you the question I asked Dr. Jarvis. What are you seeing at Maine Med and the other hospitals under the Maine Health umbrella? Are you seeing more admissions of COVID and serious influenza and RSV?
Yeah, well, actually, everything that Jim said was exactly what I was going to say. So we are the two major health systems in Maine are really seeing identical kind of situations. As Jim mentioned, we're very busy, and yet it's mostly in the outpatient settings that we're seeing a lot of respiratory illnesses. We're particularly seeing quite a bit of influenza. Our COVID hospitalizations are staying fairly stable. In fact, they're about the same as they were last summer and fall. They haven't really bumped up that much. The influenza hospitalizations have increased. So I think statewide, this last few days, there have been about 60 to 70 people hospitalized. But in many years, that's well over 100. And just to give you an idea, going back to COVID for a second, not to mix the two up so much, but the last I noticed the last couple of weeks there have been about 30 to 50 hospitalized at any given time on this Maine CDC's data, and that goes back months now. But that was 10 times that just 3 years ago. We had well over 400 hospitalized with COVID in January, February of 2022. So we're much better than certainly we were 3 years ago. But and so COVID hospitalizations have stayed about fairly steady. Flu hospitalizations are up, but not anything like it's not an unusual increase. It's something we kind of in a moderate year we would see. But we are hearing of a lot of outpatient ambulatory care centers that, for instance, that are primary care providers that are very busy seeing a lot of outpatients with influenza, primarily, some COVID too. And then RSV, as Jim mentioned, we've had some kids hospitalized with RSV, some older people, but not a huge spike like we saw again 2 years ago. So seeing more in the outpatient settings than inpatient settings, and the hospitalizations are mostly amongst for flu and COVID are mostly those 60 and older or very young children under 5, and those in between with chronic conditions. And the deaths are also mostly people six over 60.
All right. Dr. Jarvis, I understand that a couple weeks ago, the Calais school system shut school because so many staff members had the flu. And I've heard of some other after-school programs going on hold for a few days. And I'm wondering if you have a sense of if there are parts of the state, if there are areas where the flu seems to be worse right now.
Yeah, I don't think we have any data that's that specific to be able to say that. And anecdotally, we've been hearing from every part of the state, particularly around influenza and norovirus. I have a daughter who's an elementary school teacher, and at any given time, several of her kids are out with one or several of those particular illnesses. So I think it really is statewide. I think you're going to see, as we always do, there'll be a little bit of a peak and a little bit of a lull. And certainly in a particular school, that may be the case because the school may just have it go through the school all at one time and then resulting in things like needing to curtail extracurricular activities or even closing school down just simply because of the high rate of both students and staff who are out.
All right. Dora, Dr. Mills, I understand. I was going to say the flu can be very serious. Sometimes we can be nonchalant about it because it's such a part of life. But I know somebody who died of influenza several years ago, and you had the misfortune of getting it this year. Tell us what that was like.
Yeah, and actually, I am in my office at work. Without a mask on right now because the door's closed, but I am back at work and wearing a mask right now. But I just came down with it last week. I have not had influenza in years, but did come down with it. I guess it was Thursday. I was at work on Thursday and I thought I was starting to come down with a cold. So I put a mask on. I was at work and I thought, well, put a mask on. I seem to be coming down with a cold. And then Thursday evening, my fever spiked up to 102. So I knew I had much more than a cold. But I had, cough and a sore throat, congestion, and a lot of aches. So fortunately, a few weeks ago, I had bought a home testing kit for both flu and COVID. The COVID home tests have been around for several years now, but the COVID and flu tests for home use just are fairly new. And I use my HSA card, my healthcare savings account card, to buy one. They're not cheap. It was like they're kind of expensive, like $40 for a test kit. But I Thursday night in the middle of the night, I took the test and it showed that I had influenza A. It was negative for influenza B and negative for COVID. And that was a very big help to me because I am at high risk because of my age and the fact that I've been on prednisone for a while. So I was very fortunate. I got on the portal for my PCP and let them know. And by Friday morning, they faxed a or sent a prescription to a pharmacy for Tamiflu, and I was able to get on Tamiflu by 10 o'clock in the morning. I had my first dose. I also was vaccinated, so I'm actually kind of walking proof of how this is the vaccines and Tamiflu are really like very much life-saving and certainly saving of one's health. So I had a high fever, felt quite ill for about 36 hours, and by Saturday evening, it just felt like it lifted, and that was I felt fine. I went for a walk yesterday, so I'm back at work, and I'm congested still. You can kind of tell probably my voice, but I'm feeling very fine. And yet, the only other time I know that I got the flu, I was in my 30s, very healthy, had been vaccinated, and but I got influenza B at that time, which was not reflected in the vaccine. So this is back in the 90s, and I was flat on my back for a week and ended up in the ER for several hours with IV fluids. So, I was a marathon runner at the time, extremely healthy, and was flattened by it. So the fact that I'm much older now, and also on high risk for several reasons, and yet I was able to bounce back very quickly because of the flu vaccine and then getting easy access to Tamiflu, partly because I had a home testing kit. So yeah,
Right.
one of the bottom line lessons of all that is if you have an HSA or ability to buy a home testing kit for flu and COVID, it's not a bad idea to try to have one in hand.
Yes. So just to be clear, the difference is if you did not have that home testing kit, you would have called and made an appointment with your primary care provider, gone the next day, possibly exposed other people in the waiting room and in the office to the flu, gotten a positive test there, gotten the prescription. You would have
Waited.
And then you would have had to wait that much longer for the Tamiflu. So that's a real, and I didn't even know a home flu test existed. So that's great news. Dr. Jarvis, I'm going to turn to you. Okay, we don't want to get the flu. We don't want to get COVID. What can we do? Is it too late to get vaccinated since we are in the middle of flu season?
It is not too late to get it. Just understand that, getting the shot, it does take a little bit of time, up to 2 weeks for your immune system to rev up after getting your vaccine, but is definitely not too late. So if you have not received an updated booster for COVID or an updated annual influenza shot, definitely go out and get that. And if you meet the criteria for an RSV vaccine, you should consider that as well. That really is people over the age of 65 and definitely people over the age of 75. And then we were recommending it for pregnant women who were going to deliver their babies during this time, but that ended on the 31st of January. So now it's just important that if we have a baby that's born to a mom who hasn't been vaccinated against RSV this season, that there is actually a treatment that we can use that can help prevent the baby from catching RSV if mom had not been vaccinated. So those are those categories. And yes, it's definitely important for people if they haven't to get it, because again, we are in the midst of a very high rate of things. If we look, it's kind of interesting because if we look at what The federal CDC is reporting about Maine. They put us in the minimal to maybe moderate category for disease prevalence because they look at the number of people who get admitted to the hospital and the number of people that present to emergency room with symptoms like this. But if we look at the wastewater data from the CDC for all three of those viruses, influenza, COVID, and RSV, we are in the very high category. So, it's one of those things where I think right now, we just as Dora said, we are seeing far more people present more to ambulatory or outpatient with these symptoms than they are to hospitals and getting admitted. That's good news for us. Some of that probably has to do with traditionally, we have a higher vaccination rate than other places do, but definitely these diseases are out there. And you don't want to be one of those small number of people who winds up being ill, have to be hospitalized, or worse, die from a disease that can be prevented from vaccination. The other thing we can do, stay home if we're not feeling well. So Dora was very good. She had a fever. She tested. She stayed home. She waited till that was over before she went back to work, and she's wearing a mask. Right now at Eastern Maine Medical Center, we are having our staff mask 100% of the time, and that's because we saw that we had our own staff who were coming down with these illnesses, and we can't afford to have them out from work, so we want to protect them as well. And then doing good habits, coughing into a Kleenex or tissue or into the crux of your elbow, so that you're not spreading those germs out there. And then using good hand hygiene, washing your hands regularly, and using hand sanitizer. I shared a story earlier. I'm fortunate enough that I get to be the team physician for the UMaine women's basketball team, Go Blue. And I carry a little hand sanitizer with me whenever I'm out on the court because I have to. I mean, part of my job is to interact with individuals and to touch individuals and shake hands and things like that. And so I'm constantly using hand sanitizer because I don't want to go through what Dora went through. I want to try to stay safe as I possibly can.
Yeah, and you definitely don't want to get any of the lady black bears sick for sure.
That is absolutely true because they are having a they are once again doing a very good season here in the conference, and so we're happy about that.
Oh, wow. And Dr. Mills, I want to ask you about avian flu. What do we know about where Maine is in terms of our risk for avian flu?
Well, there's so avian flu, H5N1, is something that has been circulating for at least several decades that we know of, less about 25 or so years, in amongst migratory waterfowl. And then it now is circulating quite prevalently in the United States. There are two clades or two groups of it. So one group, genetic group of it, is circulating amongst cows in across the country, and particularly dairy cows. We don't know of any dairy cows in Maine. There's no evidence of it being circulating in cows in Maine, so that's good. It's been mostly in California and right now in cows out there. There's a second clade or second genetic group of H5N1 or avian flu that is circulating amongst poultry. So again, the reservoir, the carriers for avian flu tend to be migratory waterfowl, like Canada geese, Arctic terns, birds like that. But then when they intermingle with poultry, domestic birds and or cows, that's is where it gets transmitted to those animals. And so there are a number of poultry farms across the country that are being devastated, because once this is an extraordinarily lethal and highly contagious disease amongst poultry, particularly. So when it hits, when avian flu hits a coop, for instance, one with egg-laying hens, it wipes out the entire coop very quickly, so much so that they generally have to depopulate the coop first, before it kills them all anyway. So what we found, what's been concerning, is that there have been a number of poultry farms impacted from across the country in the last few weeks, Georgia and Maryland and in the Midwest and a variety of different states. Again, I have not heard of any poultry here in Maine have been impacted. And then I would mention, just as a quick aside, is that people might have heard of some couple of, I think it was Canada geese in the Southern York County that were found to be positive about a week or two ago by some state or federal wildlife officials. And Again, they did have symptoms, so and were found to be positive. That is not unusual because they are migratory waterfowl or waterfowl that we have a lot of Canada geese that don't migrate that far. But that's not unusual to see them, and a lot of them tolerate it and don't get sick and die from it. But those two geese did. So that was not a alarming concern because that's we see them a lot in that as well, in those anyway. But the problem is that we don't fully know the extent right now of H5N1 across the country because we're not hearing from the US CDC. So the MMWR, the morbidity mortality weekly report, is something that comes out every week on Thursday afternoons, has been for about 70 years. And it's something that physicians and public health professionals monitor. It's really our news for what's going on in the world for public health. And for the first time, it has not been published the last 2 weeks. And they were supposed to have a special issue a week and a half ago on H5N1, and it did not get published. So it's concerning because we keep hearing reports of avian flu spreading amongst poultry, and yet we're just hearing reports here and there, and yet CDC is the agency that usually compiles that data and communicates it out.
Is this not being published because we're in a transition and there's not leadership, there's a leadership vacuum right now at the CDC, or is this an intentional decision by the new administration, the Trump administration, to not re release this?
I don't know. We just don't know. But it is concerning. What we do know is that we've had about 67 human cases in the country in the last year or so. But we have not seen evidence of human to human, significant human to human transmission. So that's the good news. So I'm not losing sleep over this at night, but it's certainly something that I'm concerned about. Having followed avian flu for now, 20 some odd years, almost 30 years, I think. I've never seen it this extent across the country. But again, it's mostly in cows and in birds or in poultry. And so not a lot of evidence of not evidence right now of human to human transmission. But I am concerned that if we're not hearing from US CDC, then how do we really know what's going on? And it's extraordinarily important, critical for us to be able to track this efficiently.
Well, we do need to go to a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking with medical leaders today about infectious diseases and other public health issues in Maine. My guest, Dr. Jim Jarvis, Director of Clinical Education for Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. We invite you to join the conversation. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we get to calls, though, I do want to ask some specific questions about how the new administration is affecting what you do. Dr. Jarvis, I'm going to go to you. I know that your hospital is involved in research that's funded by, as Dr. Mills is, research and treatment that is tied up with federal funding. And I'm wondering if you have already experienced changes, if you're already putting things on hold.
Yeah, the good news is that for Northern Light Health, we have not put anything major on hold or had to do any of that. It is challenging every time we have a new administration, whether that be a Republican or a Democratic administration, just simply because policies change and things like that. I think what was more drastic for this particular change in administration was when they had paused for a little bit. Federal funding through grants and loans and things like that. And we do depend on those for a lot of things, like you just said, research projects and things. Thankfully, right now, that has not affected us. We've been able to continue our projects as we see going forward. But it is something that's challenging. I personally have some staff that work for me that their job is funded entirely by grant. And of course, they are nervous when they hear things like, oh, well, grant funding may go away because that involves them personally and their livelihood. But right now we are continuing to manage as we have been because we haven't been affected by things that have been directly told to be stopped at this point.
And Dr. Mills, I read that there's a hospital in New York that halted its services to transgender youth in the last week. And I'm wondering if Maine Med has done the same thing.
No, we've not.
All right. We'll go to calls now. We'll start with Susan, who's calling from Freiburg. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you very much, Jennifer, for your always relevant, timely, and very critically important programs. I have a couple things. I'll try and be brief. I am just recovering from a very, excuse me, very bad cold with the hacking cough 3 weeks now. It was not COVID. I have not been able to call out of work. But I wanted to appeal to the public. I work in a retail pharmacy where you can buy those flu tests. And I would just ask anyone not feeling well or having people in their households not feeling well when they come in to buy COVID tests, flu tests, and I'm surprised we have any cough medicine left, that you wear masks and use sanitizer. Perhaps the doctors on the air can say if that is useful. I wore a mask for 2 weeks while I was really sick. So I think it's very important. I'm quite sure I got my illness at work. So I would just appeal for that. And just on a much bigger picture issue, on the CDC not sending out health notices, it is, according to my very reliable sources, very intentional that CDC is not sending out the very critical weekly updates because of the Trump administration's directives. And I find this unconscionable, life-threatening, and I hope somebody is going to track perhaps deaths that result from this. I hope that will change in the very near future. Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you for your call, Susan. Dr. Jarvis, a personal plea from somebody who works at a retail pharmacy. Please, if you're not feeling well, wear a mask. I suspect people who work at Hannaford and Shaw's would say the same thing. You're coming in to buy cough medicine. You're buying it for a reason. Wear a mask.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I also think that those individuals who are at risk for more severe disease from having getting influenza or COVID or even RSV, that they should consider wearing a mask as well when they're going to be in a crowded place, particularly if they're going to be in that place for more than 15 to 20 minutes, because that's what we know is the usual length of time it takes for exposure for these infections to take hold. So I think that's still great advice. Like I said, at Eastern Maine Medical Center, our staff are all wearing masks for that very reason, because we want to protect ourselves and protect the public as well. So those are very key things.
All right, Susan, thanks so much for your call. We'll move up to Topsom and Juliana. Hi, Juliana, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call, Jennifer. I'm really calling on behalf of our advocacy, our healthcare grassroots advocacy group, Healthcare Advocates for Maine. And we are inclusive of all medical professionals throughout the state. And we have a question that we've raised with Senator Collins, particularly during a recent video meeting with her just a few weeks ago about how Maine supports our vaccine law in the state, which we passed in referendum. And I'm a registered nurse, and I have worked with been privileged to work with medical providers like your panelists. Excuse me, my voice. I also am getting over a cold. Anyway, the thing is, we've been advocating for Maine's vaccine laws for years, and I know I went back to as early as 2015 to testify in support of the law. And then, of course, we had the referenda and all 16 counties supported Maine's vaccine law. And right now, where it seems as though the current nomination by President Trump is for a Health and Human Services director who opposes vaccine, or at least he has vocalized that in the past many times, that maybe our own vaccine law could be at risk, even though it has been fully endorsed by the entire state through referenda. We also raised with Senator Collins the subject of medical research, because apparently that's at risk, too, with this nomination. And the subject came up about Lyme disease in the discussion with her. And we reminded her that Maine has one of the highest tick-borne disease rates in the nation, and a population who is over 65 years old are very much at risk for these diseases. And so we really would like to see a candidate in that position who's going to support medical research so we can continue to develop vaccines to protect against illnesses like tick-borne diseases and also some cancers. There are cancers now that are being researched to be preventable with some vaccines. So we wanted to make people in Maine aware. We had a sign-on letter that has been currently signed by 365 medical professionals from all the professions throughout the state of Maine. And she has that letter, and she agreed that she would listen to our concerns. But during our call, she didn't make any commitment, of course.
Okay. Juliana, thank you so much for calling. Juliana with a group, Healthcare Advocates for Maine. And Dora, what can you say to Juliana about what you know about how the new administration affects, for example, what she brought up at the beginning, Maine's vaccination law requiring children in school be vaccinated?
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you, Juliana, for your advocacy and your longtime advocacy. The good news, I believe, is that, the public health laws in the Constitution are conferred to states. So our state law, I'm not a lawyer, I should first of all mention so, but having directed the Maine CDC for nearly 15 years, I am somewhat familiar with public health laws. And so the good news is that state laws generally for public health are those that that stay in place, that those are the ones that take precedence over the federal laws. So, I mean, federal laws are in the Constitution, the federal public health authorities are really deferred to states. So anyway, so that's the good news. So hopefully it should hold up. And of course, the federal government does have other mechanisms like funding and things like that they can, other strings that they can use. But generally, the laws, public health laws, are deferred to states. So that's the good news. And thank you so much again for all your advocacy.
Thank you, Jill. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Jarvis.
I'm sorry, Jen, go ahead. I just wanted to echo, thank you for your advocacy. And then both Maine Health and Northern Light Health are involved in Lyme vaccine trials as we speak. And so it's important that we be able to continue those kind of work, particularly for the state of Maine where Lyme disease is more prevalent.
Yeah, Dr. Jarvis, I'm going to go to Buddy on Facebook who says, did I hear that right? She was vaccinated and still got the flu. Why bother getting vaccinated in the first place? So I think, I'm going to go to Dr. Jarvis, Dr. Mills, because I heard you clearly. You believed you would have had it much worse if you hadn't been vaccinated. And Dr. Jarvis, I think a lot of people feel this way, whether it's the COVID vaccine or the flu vaccine. Hey, I got vaccinated. I still got it. Why bother?
Yeah, and this is, I think, one of those kind of things that we really need to think a little bit broader about that. And so, yes, vaccines do help prevent you from getting disease, but they also help lessen the effects when you have the disease. And that's the key thing, is that we know that when we get vaccinated, that if we are exposed in a significant amount of number, it can overcome the ability to prevent the disease, but it also allows our own immune system to work. I always make the analogy of, okay, you get into a car accident and you're wearing your seatbelt and you only have a minor illness for a minor accident or injury from that. Does that mean that you're never going to wear a seatbelt again because you had the accident in the first place? No. Same thing with airbags, brakes. Yes, you can still get into the accident, but those other things help prevent you from having further injury from that accident. Think about vaccines in the same way. They can help prevent that accident or the infection, But if you do have the accident or you get infected, it can lessen the injury to your body if you do, meaning that your symptoms are much less. And that is particular for those people who have chronic illnesses. So it is very important that we get vaccinated. I hear this every year when we come out with reports about the efficacy of the influenza vaccine. And they say, oh, well, it's only 40%. So why is that good? Well, that means that it makes our chance of getting infected less by 60%. And it means that if you did get infected, you still have some protection. And so those are the kind of things that you know, it's challenging when we talk about that. But that's the reason why we have health experts to kind of talk about this and explain things in a more reasonable and rational sense that we can all understand that it is important because it does two things. It can help prevent disease. But even if you get the disease, it'll make that disease less dangerous to us.
So following your car analogy and the seatbelt, that if you're in an accident and wearing a seatbelt, you may break some ribs, but you did not go through the windshield and you are still alive.
Correct. And that's really the same thing that happens with vaccines. And DOR is now a living proof of that.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that analogy. We're speaking with Dr. Dora Mills and Dr. James Jarvis about what's going on right now, what's circulating. We're talking about the COVID in the wastewater and the increase in flu cases. What are your questions? 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're learning about medical issues in the news. Dr. Dora Mills with Maine Health and Dr. Jim Jarvis with Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. For so long, it felt like whenever we had you two on the program, we were talking about where we were with the COVID vaccines, and it got really confusing. If you are someone who had a vaccine in October, Dr. Mills, are you all set for this season? Oh, dear. It looks like we've lost Dr. Mills. We'll turn to you, Dr. Jarvis.
Yeah, for the majority of the population, they would be all set. There may be those individuals who are at high risk who would still need to get another one about 6 months after they had received that last one.
Okay, so who is that person? Who is that person listening today and thinking, I need a second vaccine?
So typically we talk about those individuals who are over the age of 60 or those individuals who have chronic illnesses. And that would be somebody that you'd really want to reach out to your provider to make sure that you're getting the most up-to-date recommendation as those recommendations change on a fairly regular basis.
All right. We're going to go to Amy, who's calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting and timely program. For many reasons. I'm a nurse. I actually just retired, but I was a nurse for 35 years in an emergency department. I am also a proud member of Maine State Nursing Association and the National Nurses United. And I just wanted to make a statement, not really ask a question. Maine State Nursing Association under National Nurses United have come out opposing the nomination and appointment of RFK Jr. We feel that he is a risk to the public health of the people in this country. And I think there are many healthcare professionals that feel the same way, both in public health and primary health, mental health, and every kind of health. hope that people will call their senators, Collins and King, and also ask them to oppose this appointment to Secretary of Health and Human Services of RFK Jr.
Amy, thanks for your comment. And we have a similar email from Sarah who writes, what can local physicians, healthcare systems, and state level public health agencies do to protect the health of Mainers as the federal level public health infrastructure is being dismantled? Dr. Jarvis, thoughts about what the role is of your hospital, the state CDC,
other public health officials and on the local level?
Yeah, well, clearly our responsibility is to help take care of the health and well-being of Mainers, and we need to continue to do that as best that we can. You know, one of the things that I always share with my friends who ask why I live in Maine, I say because Maine has always supported public health and that we really do a good job. One of our earlier callers talked about the referendum on requiring vaccinations for children who are entering school, as well as healthcare workers. You know, that's an important thing that we need to continue to have those discussions. You can look at how we responded to the incredible once in a lifetime, which I hope it stays a once in a lifetime pandemic. You know, our state came together. I proudly talk about that, you know, when I helped oversee the vaccination clinic at the Cross Insurance Center in Bangor, you know, I saw people of all walks of life come through. Never did we have a fight over ideology. It was all about protecting Mainers and ourselves. And I think that's just kind of the thing that we just have to continue to do as we go forward. Certainly individuals have the right talk to their elected leaders and express their opinions as they see fit. But again, makes me proud to be a Mainer.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that. I mean, we are so fortunate in Maine that our community hospitals are all nonprofit and they really work together as part of the major part of the public health infrastructure in Maine. When I was at Maine CDC and did not work for a hospital, I used to say that, and I still say it now, that we are very fortunate to have a statewide network of hospitals that provide a tremendous amount of public health function in Maine.
Thank you, Amy. We'll go to Mary, who's calling from Elliott. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to know about RSV testing. Recently, I went to a walk-in clinic, and I was negative for A, B, and COVID, but yet very sick. And there was no RSV test provided, even though I'm over 75. I'm not particularly compromised, but certainly was feeling compromised. So what are the why isn't it tested? Also, what are the benefits of the RSV vaccine? And what are the drawbacks of the vaccine because of some potential complications that might result as after being vaccinated? So can you comment on those?
Jim, Dr. Jarvis.
Yeah, so I'll first comment on the testing thing. So not every place has the readily availability to test for RSV. It's not as common a test as we do for influenza, and certainly since COVID came on board for COVID. One of the reasons for that is there isn't a treatment specific to RSV. We talk about supportive care, so the same kind of thing that we do with other respiratory illnesses, unlike influenza and COVID, which both have a treatment that can be given to people. And so that's one of the reasons why a lot of smaller places do not test specifically for RSV. As far as the RSV vaccine goes, it is recommended, like I said, for anyone over the age of 75. For people 65 to 75, they may want to have a discussion with their doctor. And that's because there has been some limited talk about some cardiac conditions that may result from the RSV vaccine. It's extremely rare. Again, this is a very, very, very safe vaccine. And what we know right now is that this vaccine is one that once you get it, you don't need to get it again unless you're in the subpopulation of pregnant women, where we think, again, they probably are get lifelong immunity, but they may have to have a discussion later on about getting a vaccine when they turn 65. We know for a fact that because this RSV vaccine, the people who were in the original trials, they are now 4 years out from that. So we know we have 4 years of coverage with the RSV vaccine. And that's the reason why we think it's a lifelong one. And also because the RSV virus itself doesn't change much, unlike influenza and COVID, which mutate all the time, which is why we have to continue to get revaccinated against those diseases. So I hope that answered most of those questions.
Yeah, Mary, thanks for your questions. We will go to North Haven and Becky. Hi, Becky, go ahead.
Hi, I am a small farmer and I have chickens and sheep. And I'm really curious if Dr. Mills particularly knows anything about, you know, the nature of the farming that where there's the outbreak of avian flu in both dairy cows and also in poultry. I'm just wondering if it's typically larger scale situations where it is occurring across the country.
Yeah, great question. It is my belief is it is both, but what we're hearing about is mostly the large scale poultry farms, because of course that's impacting the grocery store, seeing the the eggs on not on the shelves, or the prices going up so rapidly. The main thing, as you may know, as a backyard poultry farmer, is to make sure to keep your flocks away from migratory birds. Migratory, especially the migratory waterfowl, tend to be the reservoir. They tend to keep it in their guts, and some of them get sick and die from it, but most of them do not. They tend to carry it. And so when they intermingle with backyard flocks or, poultry farms, large scale poultry farms, then that's when it gets transmitted to poultry. And domestic poultry are much more susceptible. They die very fast from it. So it's important to keep water, migratory birds, particularly migratory waterfowl, away from your birds. And I realize that's easier said than done. But I know there's sometimes people have they have mesh wiring on around the poultry farm and that kind of thing. But it's if you have a fairly large farm, it's sometimes harder to do that. So, but as much as possible. And there's ways that the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife and the USDA have websites on how to do that, which you're probably quite familiar with. But so there's websites on how to protect your backyard flocks from avian flu.
Okay, thank you, Becky, for your call. An email here from Bob. Bob writes, I want to remind pet owners that cats are coming down with avian flu in large numbers from raw food and barn cats eating wild mice. Not sure if it's hit Maine at this point, but it will if it keeps spreading. Are you, Dr. Jarvis, concerned about pets getting avian flu?
At this time, I'm not aware of any widespread thing like that. I think, as Dora said, domestic fowl are probably more the worrisome thing at this point. But again, when we see things cross species like we did here with the avian flu now infecting cattle, we always worry about what else that could happen. Of course, right now our focus is, will it mutate in a way that it infects more humans? So I think it all just bears watching. I
Yeah,
do
and
want to quickly just say that I misspoke on the RSV vaccine risk. I meant to say neurologic, not cardiac conditions. There is a that that there, for older people, there is a higher risk of something called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Again, very, very rare. This is a very safe vaccine. So thanks for letting me correct that.
yeah, thank you. And I want to mention all these questions about avian flu and what's going on with the poultry population. We actually just did a Maine calling on Friday, and Dr. Honig, the former Maine State veterinarian, was a guest. So if you want to learn even more, you can go to mainecalling.org and look at Friday's program. We are almost out of time, but I realize that I have not yet brought up whooping cough. Is there a season for whooping cough? It seems, though, Dr. Mills, that every year we're talking about these new cases of it. Are we seeing them now, or is this not the right time?
Yeah, no, it's usually in the winter. I mean, we can see it other times of year for sure. But just like most other respiratory viruses, we tend to see those in the wintertime for a variety of reasons, including the fact that we're indoors around each other a lot and, coughing, et cetera. We're also seeing more pertussis, probably a whooping cough, because we're testing for it more. We used to not be able to test for it as easily. So we test for it more, and we're finding it more in adults as well as kids. The main thing is we all should be vaccinated, because for especially young children, it is extremely dangerous, particularly those under 1 years of age, particularly, and many of them are too young to be fully vaccinated. So it's something that we all get vaccinated to protect each other and ourselves, but also in this case, especially infants.
All right. And one more question. We're talking about at the very beginning of the program, you all talked about seeing fewer COVID hospitalizations, thank goodness, than we saw even 3 years ago. But Dr. Jarvis, the fact that we have high levels of the COVID virus in these wastewater tests, does that mean that we're about to see a surge or not necessarily?
Yeah, we really don't know. But we have for most of the time since COVID became a disease that we've been following, when we start to see a spike in wastewater, it's usually followed by increased illness and then hospitalization. But again, this virus has mutated so fast and so many times that it's hard to kind of predict the actual disease that'll be caused. So thankfully, right now, we're at a period where, because we have a large number of people who've been vaccinated, some multiple times, a large number of people who've been infected, so we have kind of that herd immunity that we've been keeping this virus under control. And so not as much severe illness, but, you know, one mutation can switch that on, and all of a sudden, we're talking about all the hospitalizations again.
Boy, we could keep talking to you all afternoon, but we're out of time. Thank you so much, as always, Dr. Jim Jarvis, the Director of Clinical Education for Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, challenges facing refugees and asylum seekers in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.